The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York with an original in-depth investigative report, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'm not sure whether or not the radiation could spread to the U.S. West Coast in any significant amounts, personally. I'm going to give you my answer. I have read most everything that I could get my hands on. I believe that the threat is minimal. However, there's a couple of hysterics out there, such as a nuke expert Joe Cerincione, who says that radiation from Japan's multiple potential nuclear meltdowns could spread to the U.S. West Coast, and that the threat represents an unprecedented crisis. I don't agree with that. Cerincione was on Fox News with Meatloaf Jr., Chris Wallace, spreading the propaganda, and he said, oh, yes, it could happen. It could travel thousands of miles. Chernobyl, which happened, blah, 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 and he went on. And he said, we've never had a situation like this before. Now, it is possible that radiation could reach the United States. However, it's very unlikely that it would reach the United States in any amount to cause any problem. This is not to say that radiation could not spread to the U.S. West Coast. However, at this time, I think it's very unlikely, number one. And number two, if it did reach the United States West Coast, it would be so dispersed by that point that it would be of no threat whatsoever. That would be my let us say, educated guess. It doesn't mean that I'm 100% right either, because it's not over.
Oh, and another thing. Don't even get me started on nuclear energy and how dangerous nuclear energy is. Oh, as horrible as a Three Mile Island accident. If I hear that one more time, blood's going to shoot out of my head. Oh, it is. It is. It might be from a self-inflicted gun wound because I can't take it anymore. Oh, this tragedy could be as bad as Three Mile Island. Oh, I could only wish it were.
And don't where no one died?
Yeah, where no one died.
Yeah.
There wasn't even a bird that dropped dead.
Where the maximum exposure was a set of full chest x-rays.
And, oh, well, this could turn into Chernobyl. No, it won't. You know why it won't turn into Chernobyl? Because the Japanese are not the Russians. The Russians suck. Did you see the Zill? Why we ever said, hey, they could make a really crappy car. Let's have them build a nuclear power plant. Hello?
But we know it's going to be dangerous, though, because the peak radiation measured in Japan is 1/4,000th of what it would need to be really dangerous. So if that, if only it happens 4,000 times, we've got it coming then.
You look out, because, you know, when they take that x-ray, they're getting less exposure than that.
This is why we should build no more nuclear power plants.
No more nuclear power. Oh, by the way, I did you guys get the email that I sent about 2 o'clock in the morning about 4 days ago?
I know. Luckily, I wasn't on that list of that one.
I read a story from I think it was England that was talking about how nuclear energy, how this is going to be so horrible. This is going to be the worst thing ever. And I looked it up because one of the commentators that were, you know, they went to the experts. It was some plowshare thing. And I went, plowshare? Gee, that just sounds like either Isaiah, so it's a man of God, or it's a Marxist. I looked it up. Yeah. George Soros and Tides created fund. And then there was another expert that was quoted from some other, you know, hey, we're just like you foundation. And, you know, and I looked that one up. Yeah. What a surprise. Started with George Soros money. And run through the Tides Foundation.
I had the same exact experience. I was reading one of these. It was like, nuclear disaster, and I scrolled down the story, and who they're quoting is the Union of Concerned Scientists. I was like, oh, phew. I thought it was going to be really a nuclear disaster. Now I know it's them, so it's really, not going to be a disaster.
I thought it was really going to be actual credible scientists for a second. Then I realized, no, it's just propaganda from George Soros.
Jay, I'm looking at not only the contamination story of the USS Reagan Navy crew members, but, you know, this is a race against time. You know, Japan's frantic efforts to avoid a meltdown. Some people say we were told not to breathe the air. It's scary. How realistic is this threat?
Sean, it's not at all realistic. I can tell you with the utmost confidence there will not be a health impact of anything that's going on at the Fukushima power plant. A meltdown, people interpret it as virtually a disaster, an explosion, destruction like an atomic bomb. That's not true at all. A meltdown just means that the cooling of the rods has failed. The temperature is higher than can be controlled in order to create the hot water that ultimately flashes to steam and turns a turbine. So they immediately install rods to bring the radioactive decay down to subcritical, but they have leftover heat and residual radiation that has to be brought under control. It will happen naturally within a few days. They're doing the best they can, but a total meltdown has only occurred at Three Mile Island back in 1979. That was a disaster of a nuclear plant considered 10 times more serious than Fukushima, and the rods actually did melt down, fell to the floor of the reactor building, and they only melted 5/8 of an inch into 5 inches of steel before they cooled and the situation stopped. And as you well know, there were no health impacts from Three Mile Island. There will not be any health impacts here. The nuclear engineers in Japan are doing a magnificent job under a situation that could never be expected, and the public in Japan has enough to worry about with a horrible disaster worrying that there's going to be a nuclear explosion.
Tonight, Ann Coulter has a new column out today about the nuke situation in Japan, and here she is. The column is entitled A Glowing Report on Radiation. Glowing radiation, very, very good. But you are not down on radiation poisoning.
Well, it's not me. I'm citing a stunning number of physicists. And from the New York Times and the Times of London, there's a growing body of evidence that radiation in excess of what the government says are the minimum amounts right. You should be exposed to are actually good for you and reduce cases of cancer. The New York Times science section, for example, a few years ago reported on a study from Canada where all these women who had tuberculosis got an inordinate number of chest x-rays. Well, their breast cancer rate was lower than the general population. There were apartments put up in Taiwan in 1993 that accidentally contained an inordinate amount of cobalt-60, a radioactive substance. After 16 years, 10,000 occupants of these buildings being hit with five times what the government says is the minimum amount you should be hit with. The number of cancer cases they had, there were about 10,000 occupants, was only five cases. Now, for the general population in that same age group, a group of 10,000 Taiwanese should have gotten about 170 cases
of cancer.
So
why, if those things have happened, why isn't the established medical organizations or establishment saying that, you know, some kind of radiation can ward off infections? Why aren't they saying?
Well, they are. They're not getting...
I'm Gary Knoll. Let us now go to the United Kingdom. My guest, Dr. Christopher Busby. He is one of England's leading experts in low-dose ionizing radiation's effects on human health and the environment. He is the director of the environmental consultancy group Green Audit and the scientific secretary to the European Committee on Radiation's Risks based in Brussels. He's also a visiting professor in biomedical sciences at the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland. He has been a member of several large governmental committees in the United Kingdom, including its oversight group on depleted uranium used in radioactive weapons in the Middle East, and the committee to examine nuclear emissions and their risks. Nice to have you with us today.
Yes, hello.
You've heard some of America's leading radio and television personalities, including Michael Savage, Glenn Beck, Jay Lear, talking with Sean Hannity, Ann Coulter, and Bill O'Reilly. they are all pro-nuclear and all have on a regular basis downplayed any significance to this as far as if radiation does hit the United States, it will not be a problem. We have 104 very safe nuclear facilities in the United States. There had been no deaths, no injuries. There were no deaths or injuries from Three Mile Island, and only an insignificant amount of deaths and injuries from Chernobyl. That is what they're stating. I would like for you, who have actually spent a great deal of time examining the scientific literature, including the work of the great scientist Dr. Alexei Yablokov, who we were to have on today, to summarize his assessment on the number of deaths worldwide that can be attributed to Chernobyl, to tell us the truth about the safety of low-level ionizing radiation contamination, and also to explain the fundamental difference between the health risks of cancer imposed by internal and external radiation absorption.
Yes, well, that's my field. I mean, and I am a researcher in that area. I have made a significant theoretical advances, which have been published in the peer-reviewed literature, and also epidemiological studies in many areas where low-level radiation is involved, including uranium. Recently did a study in Fallujah in Iraq. So what I have to say about the people that I've been listening to talking about the effects of low-dose radiation and the development of nuclear power is that actually none of these people are scientists, and what they're saying is criminally irresponsible. Because they're wrong in everything that they've said. If we go to the Three Mile Island accident, there was a study made by Professor Steve Wing a few years ago of the populations who were exposed at Three Mile Island, which showed that there were significant increases in cancer in that population. And in fact, I've done many studies around operational nuclear plants, never mind about ones that have melted down or had accidents, which have showed that there are excess risks of breast cancer and other cancers, leukemias and so forth, around all of those plants. The German government did an enormous study of all the German plants, which was published in 2007, and this is an official German cancer registry study, which showed that there was a significant excess of childhood leukemias around all of the nuclear plants in Germany. And if we look at the literature, we find that there have been studies which show increases in childhood leukemia around almost every nuclear plant that's been studied. So first of all, we have to say that low-dose radiation is dangerous and does kill people. So now we come to the arguments about Fukushima. Now, the international, here again, we can go to the data. We don't have to just wave our arms and say it can't possibly happen and all of these nonsensical arguments that are coming out of these people that I heard talking just now, because the data is there. The International Atomic Energy Agency website, and of course, these are pro-nuclear people. So we're not talking about mad arm-waving loonies or environmentalists or Sierra Club or whatever they were saying. We're talking about the International Atomic Energy Agency have published data about the contamination around the Fukushima plant. Now, out to 78 kilometers, they say that the contamination is between 0.2 and 0.9 megabecquerels per square meter. Now, let's say that's about half a megabecquerel per square meter. A megabecquerel per square meter, incidentally, means there are 1 million disintegrations per second in a square meter of surface. We can put this in perspective, though, because we can compare that to the Chernobyl exclusion zone, where you had about half a megabecquerel per square meter in the 30-kilometer Chernobyl exclusion zone, which is fenced off at the moment. No one is allowed in there. So the levels around the Fukushima plant out to 78 kilometers radius are already, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, equal to the contamination of the Chernobyl exclusion zone out to 30 kilometers radius. So in that sense, it's already worse than the Chernobyl accident in terms of local contamination. And it's easy to calculate the total amount released on the basis of those readings. You can calculate that there's about 5 times 10 to the 15 becquerels released if you assume that that's the average contamination out to 78 kilometers. I mean, I'm sorry, these are all numbers, and they might sound a little bit sort of arcane, but they are data, and they're not my data. They're data from the IAEA. So what the IAEA is saying that this is already worse than the Chernobyl accident in terms of local contamination. But let's go to something else. Let's go to the iodine. Now, according to data, again, from the IAEA and from the Japanese authorities, the levels of iodine in water in Tokyo can be above 200 becquerels per liter. So now, according to the work that I've done and the work that Alexei Yablokov, who is my colleague on the European Committee on Radiation Risk, according to the work we've done, that will already, as it stands now, cause increases in cancer and increases in thyroid cancer in the population. But unlike the Chernobyl accident, this material has gone over Tokyo. I mean, luckily the Chernobyl accident produced a lot of radiation, but generally it didn't go to the big centers of population like Moscow or Kiev, which were close by. Kiev is really quite close, but it didn't go there in any large amount. It did, however, go to Sweden, which is several thousand kilometers away. And a study that was done in Sweden in 2004 by Professor Martin Tondell, which was again published in the peer-reviewed literature, showed that there was an 11% increase in cancer for every 100 kilobecquerels per square meter of contamination. Now, we've already shown, the IAEA has already said that the contamination around the Fukushima plant up to 78 kilometers is 500, up to approximately 500. They say between 200 and 900 kilobecquerels per square meter. So if we take 500 as an approximation, that's five times the level in Sweden. So on that basis, there'll be a 55% increase in cancer in the population living in that area. So we're talking about a catastrophe, and it is absolutely extraordinary that these guys who know nothing at all about it, who are not scientists, are quite happy to stand up in public and wave their arms around and say nothing could possibly happen. This is criminally irresponsible.
Professor Busby, would you give us more specifics on the town, the small city in Sweden, that had that is almost, I believe, close to 1,000 miles away from Chernobyl, that had rain come down where there was radiation in the rain from Chernobyl? No one knew about this. And what legacy it has left for people who cannot drink the water safely, cannot eat the fish out of the pristine lake, and are told that they must now not harvest their wild blueberries and strawberries and vegetables and mushrooms. They must go to another place in the country because where it rained that particular period of time, which was not a long rain, nor necessarily a heavy rain, but that rain that was raining down the particulate matter that got into the soil will be there for a great deal of time, and it has a lasting legacy to this day that is still considered a highly radioactive environment. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I don't know of any specific town in northern Sweden that answers to that description. The whole of northern Sweden was contaminated to a greater or lesser extent, and in fact, according to my colleagues in Stockholm, Stockholm itself was contaminated. So I really can't answer that. The fact is that all of Sweden was contaminated, and all of Finland and great parts of the Baltic states. And in fact, even where I live in Wales, where there was contamination, and what I do know about in Wales is that the cesium contamination in Wales forced exclusion zones in terms of the distribution of sheep meat, which are still in existence. So in my country, which I do know about, the National Radiological Protection Board, now the Health Protection Agency, have banned the sale of sheep meat or sheep from these upland pastures in Wales and also in Yorkshire, and that ban is still in force. And you made an interesting point, which is actually relevant to the arguments earlier about could this stuff go to the United States. The answer is it has already gone to the United States, so these people are wrong there as well, because measurements have shown, and iodine is quite easy to measure, incidentally. It has a very powerful gamma radiation signal at about 250 kilo electron volts, so it can be picked up. But what can't be picked up so easily are the particles that you mentioned. And I believe that it's these particles that are responsible for the enormously high levels of cancer and ill health, which are not predicted by the current risk model, that of the International Commission on Radiological Protection. These particles float about, and they will certainly float across the ocean to the United States and probably float across to Europe as well. We know that after the Second Gulf War, uranium particles from the Gulf War floated across to the United Kingdom. It just happens to be where the wind blows. These particles are almost like a gas. They're submicron. They're really very small microscopic particles which are easily distributed and dispersed. and they fly about the place, and they will fly across to the United States, and they will fly across to Europe. And I think it was these particles that are the problem, which are quite hard to measure. And this was a problem in Sweden. But the point about Sweden is that there was a study, a proper epidemiological study by small area, which showed that this effect existed to a highly significant level. And if you look at that study and various other studies as well, what you can deduce from them is that the current risk model, the one that everybody is using that is based on absorbed dose, doesn't work for internal radionuclides, and it doesn't work for particles to the extent of about 600-fold. So if you take the dose that they say you get, you need to really, if that's a particulate dose or an internal dose, you need to multiply it by 600 to get the real dose in terms of its effect. And that's what my colleagues and I have done on the European Committee on Radiation Risk. Alexei Yablokov, incidentally, is one of the co-authors of our 2003 and 2010 report, which shows this risk model and which enables us to predict the exact outcome of the exposures at Fukushima. We can do that. As soon as we know what those exposures are, we can work out the outcome. No problem.
We've been told, in fact, Glenn Beck has been repeating it ad nauseum, that maximum expected deaths from Chernobyl, according to the UN, would be 5,000 at the high end. But the number of people actually who died that can be counted is about around 37. Could you tell us what your work and the work of your colleagues have shown when it comes to the actual number of people who have been impacted and have died from Chernobyl?
According to it's quite difficult to do this exactly, and it depends upon a number of parameters, but at minimum it's about 1 million, and that's between about 1986 and 2004. So that was at minimum. My own feeling is it's significantly more than that, because you have a whole load of illnesses that are non-cancer illnesses, and you have a lot of infant mortality cases and deaths from heart disease and a whole range of conditions which are now known to be caused by ionizing radiation. So you can say at minimum it's 1 million people have died as a result of that, and probably I would say more like five million. That would be my estimate based on a predictive model. What Alexei has done is hasn't based this on a predictive model. He's based it on a sort of epidemiological model, looking at the outcome and then trying to see which cancers can be exposed, can be a result of radiation and which not. But the problem there is you have to consider the control group. And what we would say is that there is no control group, that actually this stuff went so far around the place that to look at high dose areas and low dose areas and compare the two and say that the difference is due to Chernobyl is probably not very accurate, because there's actually no dose area at all. There's no area where nobody was affected by this. I did a big study of infant leukemia, meta-analysis of infant leukemia, and this is a very key study. It was published last year in the International Journal of Environment and Public Health, because what I did there was I looked at children who were in the womb at the Chernobyl accident time, in the United Kingdom, in Scotland, in Wales, in Greece, in Germany, in the United States, incidentally, also. There was an increase in infant leukemia, that's leukemia in the first year of life, in children who were in the womb at the time of the Chernobyl fallout in all of these countries. And you can sort of add all of these together. So there's about a 5 million population here, a very powerful study in terms of statistics. And what we showed is that there was a statistically significant increase in infant leukemia only in those children who were in the womb at the time of Chernobyl. So the point about that is there's no other explanation. In the case of nuclear site clusters and all of these other studies, you can always say, and in fact people have said, the Chernobyl Forum say that the increases in ill health or cancer have some other cause. For instance, in Russia it was due to, in the Soviet Union it was due to radiophobia, or it was due to drinking vodka or whatever. There's always some possible alternative confounding explanation. But in the case of the children in the womb, there's no explanation. And so what it shows is that the error in the risk factor that they use nowadays, that they're using at Fukushima, is between 100 and 500 fold. So this number comes up again and again and again, and it explains everything. So really what we see here at Fukushima is a concentration of interest in a problem that really has been with us since the beginning of the nuclear age, and which has resulted in what I believe to be the largest public health scandal of human history.
I have one final question, but a sidebar question. Is it correct to state that Dr. Alexei Yablokov studied over 5,000 scientific reports, including those in the given areas, to determine the actual and projected number of deaths for Chernobyl, and that has anyone else done that type of detailed analysis before they came up with a figure?
Nobody else. Yablokov began doing this when we first started the European Committee on Radiation Risk. He was doing it in around about 2000. And when I was on the British Government Cherry Committee, he came to Oxford where we had a conference, and he said, the problem is that nobody in the nuclear industry or in the United Nations committees or any of these committees that are dealing with this are looking at the literature that's being published in the peer-reviewed journals in the Soviet Union or in the ex-Soviet Union territories, which are all written in Russian. So a lot of this stuff was translated into English, and Yablokov and I published a lot of this work in 2005 and then again in 2009. But he put a lot more together, and he collaborated with Alexei Nesterenko, who is the son of the famous Professor Nesterenko, who used to go around measuring this stuff. And so he's done an enormous amount of work. And most of the results that you see that contribute to this 1 million cancer deaths are from the literature in the Russian language and translated. Of course, the Western scientists who are in the United Nations have just totally ignored this, despite the fact that they've been told for many, many years that this is where the data is. So nobody is studying this from the West, partly because the World Health Organization has agreed to leave the study of these phenomena to the International Atomic Energy Agency following an agreement in 1959, which they signed, which is still in force. So this is the problem. None of this data is cited. So when they say, oh, there are only 500 deaths, or only there's 4,000 deaths, whatever these things, if you look at the literature, if you look at their citations, you see that they never cite any evidence that shows that they're wrong. Never.
My final question. Based upon what we have heard from the Japanese government and the scientists representing the Japanese government, and the fact that they still have, for all intents and purposes, nothing more than about a 20-kilometer, 30-kilometer safe zone. Think of all the people who are going to be living there and not move, staying there, and the adverse effects that could be happening at the levels of radiation they're exposed to. And this is going to be, I consider, a very deadly legacy for these people, because they've trusted their government, and the government has trusted these scientists. And at the end of the day, I believe that we are watching people poisoned that should not be poisoned by this radiation. I think the government should do all it can to evacuate as many people and to do the proper thing, to say this is the truth. And I don't believe that the Japanese government is doing that. Your thoughts?
I agree with you. I don't know quite what I can answer. I absolutely agree with you. What I do say, though, in addition to that, is that scientists who make these statements, which are wrong and which are false, should be put in court to answer this, because it's a sort of scientific dishonesty. You know, in a British court or in American court, you know, if you go into court as an expert witness, or if you go into court in a legal case, and you say something that's wrong, then you can be prosecuted for perjury. You can go to jail, and I think these people should, if it can be shown in a court case that they knew that there were all these questions raised by people like Yablokov, by myself, by all the researchers out there. They knew all this, but they discounted it and continued to try and push nuclear on the basis of all this false evidence that they're giving. Those people should be prosecuted. They should go to jail.
Professor Christopher Busby, thank you very much for being on our program today.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Just to emphasize, Professor Busby is England's leading expert on low-dose radiation, ionizing radiation, depleted uranium, and this is what he does as a scientist, as a professor full-time. Compare that to the people who are at the top of the program giving their opinions or having Dr. Jay Lear on. Sean Hannity, he is one of the leading so-called scientific experts for Fox. Just to put this in perspective, Dr. Lear is the science director of the extremist free market think tank, the Heartland Institute. And speaking on Fox a week ago Tuesday, he asserted that radiation fallout from the reactors in Japan poses no serious health risks to the Japanese, nor would a similar disaster be threatening to American citizens. And during an interview on Bloomberg TV, he further stated that damage to human health and life will be minimal, if at all, unquote, due to the exposure from nuclear reactor leaks. First off, just a little scholarship that the media has avoided. The Heartland Institute adamantly denies global warming and was at the forefront amongst industry-funded think tanks opposing the Kyoto Protocol. Even in the face of volumes of medical research, the Institute continues to adhere to the illusion that secondhand cigarette smoke poses no health risks. It is also a leading propaganda arm for Fox and other right-wing media on behalf of big agriculture, particularly Monsanto, for touting the safety and benefits of genetically modified foods. Now with China and Russia reevaluating their nuclear power programs, Germany shutting down 7 of its oldest reactors for a period of time to do inspections, and with the other 10 to follow, Dr. Lear has usurped the mantle to sell more nuclear power facilities to the American public, which could be upwards of 400 if Republicans have their sway. What the public must realize is that the Heartland Institute is one of the corporate elite's favored citadels, a clearinghouse for junk science solely to support the most polluting industries, petroleum, coal, nuclear, power, GMO, and tobacco. Unfortunately, the Heartland Institute now has a policy to conceal its over 2,000 sources of funding. However, we've been able to find some previous sponsors, including Koch Industries, Philip Morris, ExxonMobil, Pricewaterhouse, a major accounting firm for the energy industry, including Enron. This is specifically for Glenn Beck. You have every right to make any statement that you wish. That's our freedom of speech, and we honor that. What my problem with your statement is that you have not taken the time, as I have and others, to actually visit the individuals, interview them around Three Mile Island, to take the time to interview reporters who were there. I have. To put time aside to sit down in the homes of individuals who have been in harm's way and now to report what happened later, a year later, 5 years later. Were there adverse effects? So I'm hopeful that people in this audience will get this clip to Glenn Beck. And this is Dr. Rosalie Bartell, one of America's most esteemed scientists on nuclear energy and its effects upon human health.
The tragedy of Three Mile Island was, of course, that it did not explode in a visible way the way Chernobyl did. And as a result, radioactive gases came out, but not so instantly, and there was no fire to warn people. And as a result, the governor hesitated for a few days to order evacuation of pregnant women and children, which I had recommended, and that caused many more children all over the Northeast, in Pennsylvania, New York, and all the way up to England, to New England, and across to Europe and Wales and England to be affected by the radioactive gases that have silently escaped. And nobody died at Three Mile Island, according to the government.
There's a controversy about Three Mile Island. Some people say that you can see an increase in birth defects, an increase in spontaneous abortions. Other people say no such thing. Almost no radiation came out of Three Mile Island, and therefore it's just anecdotal data. In other words, for 3 days, radiation was pouring out of the reactor, and we did not have the dosimetry in place to be able to calculate reliably how much radioactive gas came out.
Public statistics were altered in order to hide what was going on. There is no question that someone intentionally changed the statistics on infant mortality in the United States shortly after Three Mile Island, and it is essentially a criminal act.
The work that I'm best known for is the work that I did on Three Mile Island. I didn't go down there after the accident because I knew it was extremely dangerous. One of my colleagues at The Voice, Paul Cowan, did go down there. He died of cancer when he was, I think, 38. I remember when he came into the paper and his hair was quite white, and he said, I have... When I was down there about 5 years after the accident, they read a roll call of, I think, 30 reporters who had died who had been there.
The Three Mile Island plant is down in this valley, so when the radioactive cloud was released, it actually hit the side of the mountain so that the people who were living there were really in the radioactive cloud, and they did have serious health effects in that area. Many people were damaged. There were about 2,000 cases for physical harm that were in the courts, and they kept out of the court. They dismissed about 12 expert witnesses who were physicians, oncologists, botanists, biologists, and so on, by saying they were not the expertise. And when the judge saw all the expert witnesses of the civilians dismissed from the court, she just dismissed the whole case. So none of these 2,000 cases ever made it into a U.S. court.
My husband died 7 years ago. His diagnosis was cancer of the lungs. They were still denying that there was any fallout, but my brother was in his backyard, and he came into the house, and he became very nauseated and started to have a vomiting session. And this was about, I imagine, about 2 hours after the first big cloud came up. About 4 years later, he died.
That particular morning, we walked along the river. Apparently, that was that morning that they were experiencing the problems. Obviously, we didn't know that at that time. Shortly after my basketball season of my sophomore year of college, toward the end of the season, I started to physically just feel like I didn't have the stamina. There were one or two games I was playing in where I literally asked the coach to take me out of the game because it just physically didn't feel right. I started to develop a skin rash or skin lesions, and just could not keep the food down and could just generally was not doing real well at that point. That's when we came back to Harrisburg, and I checked into the Harrisburg Hospital at that point for some tests to see what was going on. And then once they determined that, you know, the high school was within 5 miles, I was evacuated from the high school, our house was in that area, then I think they started to put two to two together. It robbed me of probably the greatest period of time in my life.
Recent research has shown a failure in the radiation risk model of the International Commission on Radiological Protection. Now, that is the organization that's constantly cited as being the most definitive as far as its accuracy. And yet, repeatedly, there is now challenges showing that they have grossly understated the amount of exposure of radiation to the public and the impact of that exposure upon the public. This was the conclusion of radiation scientists from across the world gathered for the third international conference on this in Greece. And in an extraordinary development, it was reported that in Stockholm, the recently resigned scientific secretary for the group, Dr. Jack Valentin, had conceded that the International Commission on Radiological Protection model could not, I repeat, could not be used to predict the health effects of exposures, and that for certain internal exposures it was insecure for up to two orders of magnitude. He also said that he was no longer employed by the group, and he could agree that the group and the United Nations Committee on Radiation Protection had been wrong. I repeat, he, the former director of the group and a major spokesman for the International Commission on Radiological Protection, stated that they were wrong. And in examining the evidence from Chernobyl accident and other evidence outlined, which shows large errors in their risk reporting. So therefore, when we hear people say, well, there was no major problems, A, they did not read Slavic. But my person who was supposed to be the guest today, but I could not get a translator in time, said that after 5,000 studies done in Russian and published in the peer-reviewed literature showed that there were nearly a million individuals who have died from their exposure of low-level radiation in Russia and other countries around the world. Now, from Rit Goldstein from Common Dreams, specifically about the radiation counts elevated in Japan, no one measured, I might mention, how much came out, just as no one measured Three Mile Island for the first 3 days because the actual equipment, as you heard Professor Michio Kaku state, wasn't working. So they didn't even include that. Well, also, there's a big difference. You didn't have at Chernobyl plutonium. You do have plutonium in many of America's plants, and when you mix plutonium with the other radioactive materials, you have a prescription for disaster. Keep in mind, they're trying to make it seem as if the one single element of this fissionable material will biodegrade down in about 9 to 10 days. What about the far greater amounts of all the other radioactive material that will not biodegrade down for 3 billion years, thousands of years? It'll be with us forever. And so when we hear about nuclear rain, what happens if it rains and you're in the area of a nuclear accident, there's this from a person who lived in a town in Sweden, and I'll quote this. It says, while numerous proponents of nuclear power pursue what seems an exercise in surrealism, continuing to yet extol the benefits of clean and safe nuclear energy, perhaps we should consider why so many trust that the unthinkable can never occur, at least until it does. It was the 27th April 1986 when radiation alarms sounded at Sweden's Forsmark nuclear power plant, radiation workers' clothing being the cause, though it would soon be discovered that the source of this radiation was not anything in the plant they were working at. Hours after the alarm, the then USSR began revealing Chernobyl's nuclear accident, an accident across the Baltic Sea many hundreds of miles to the southeast. Meanwhile, not far from Sweden's Baltic coast, from this nuclear facility, the city of Gävle, a city of about 1,000 miles from Chernobyl, but soon a place to be lastingly impacted by it. It was 21 years after Chernobyl fire, May 2007, when one Swedish paper headlined, quote, Swedes still dying from Chernobyl radiation. The town and what is occurring there figuring prominently in the English language article. A heavy rainstorm had struck the small city in 1986, doing so as a cloud of Chernobyl fallout was overhead. Prevailing winds at the time had driven radioactive clouds from Chernobyl over parts of Scandinavia. The International Atomic Energy Agency provided a report upon the early amounts of radiation requested and registered in Chernobyl's aftermath, a report where the town is again significantly featured. A recent article talked about this, and according to a 2006 Swedish study published in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine, it appears Sweden experienced approximately 1,000 excess cancer fatalities because of Chernobyl, the number expected to increase, the cases concentrated proportional to the level of radioactive exposure. Now, a 2007 study performed by the prestigious National Bureau of Economic Research, Cambridge, Massachusetts, based think tank examined the cognitive effects of Chernobyl's radiation upon Swedish children. It found evidence, quote, that fetal exposure to ionizing radiation damages cognitive ability at radiation levels previously considered safe. Notable, this journalist lives about 90 minutes drive from this town in Sweden, and I only heard of the cognitive problems through a chance meeting while shopping for food. I was told that an unusually high number of pregnancies during the peak radiation period had resulted in children with cognitive issues. But only some years ago, I personally had lived in the town. I had no idea of its relationship to Chernobyl until I took up residence there. Initially, one of the places I had lived was on the shore of a picturesque lake, the village it was in being about a half-hour drive from the city center. I was struck by how lovely it was until I learned one couldn't eat the fish, and it wasn't a good idea to do any swimming. Why? Radiation was the problem. 20 years after Chernobyl, in 2006, Swedish national television did a news piece entitled Chernobyl Still Affects a Town Every Day. It was the town I lived in. Among other items, it discussed how wild game is checked for radiation and how residents now travel distances to pick wild blueberries and mushrooms that they once collected locally. The effects of radiation prove lasting, and recent news reports revealed radiation has entered Japan's food chain, affecting farm produce and milk, many levels of contamination higher than the regulation limits, emphasizing that many perceive as a substantive part of the ongoing problem. The New York Times quoted Japan's deputy cabinet minister as saying that he would allow his children to eat the spinach near the nuclear facility, but such understatement has not been confined to Japan. The IAEF itself stating that only, quote, up to 4,000 cancer fatalities were resolved from Chernobyl. They are wrong. In contrast to the IAEA fatality figures, a Greenpeace report forecast 100,000 cancer deaths, and more importantly, with Slavic language documents, Chernobyl consequences of a catastrophe for people and the environment, 985,000 deaths after examining 5,000 studies. And Rick Goldstein is an American investigative political journalist based in Stockholm. So we have now those who are spinning on behalf of the nuclear industry at a time when we really should be closing every single nuclear plant. I've spent several years investigating nuclear energy and low-level radiation. I am one of three scientific authors of a major report, the first of its kind, actually documented, and it has never been refuted, showing the number of deaths, especially in infants and young children, downwind from Chernobyl. I believe that until such time that we are honest and open, we will continue to be affected by this. And this is from one of the activists out there, Chip Ward, reporting in Tom Dispatch about what it means to be in the field and what they do and how they're perceived. And this is what he says. When nuclear reactors blow, the first thing that melts down is the truth. Just as in the Chernobyl catastrophe almost 25 years ago, when Soviet authorities denied the extent of radiation and downplayed the dire situation that was spiraling out of control. Japanese authorities spent the first week of this crisis issuing conflicting and confusing reports. We were told that radiation levels were up, then down, then up, but nobody aside from the Japanese bureaucrats could verify the level, and few trusted their accuracy. The situation under control, they told us, but workers were being evacuated. There's no danger of contamination, but stay inside and seal your doors. The bureaucratization of horror into bland and reassuring pronouncements was to be expected, especially from an industry where misinformation is the rule. Although you might suppose that the nuclear industry's outstanding characteristic would be its expertise, since it's loaded with junior Einsteins who grasp the math and physics required to master the most awesome, sophisticated technological terms humans have ever created, think again. Based upon the record, its most outstanding characteristic is a fundamental dishonesty. I learned that the hard way as a grassroots activist organizing opposition to a scheme hatched by a consortium of nuclear utilities to park thousands of tons of highly radioactive fuel rods, like the ones now burning in Japan, in my Utah backyard. Here's what I took away from that experience. The nuclear industry is a snake oil culture of habitual misrepresentation, pervasive wishful thinking, deep denial, and occasional outright deception. For more than 50 years, it has habitually lied about risks and costs while covering up every violation and failure it could. Whether or not its proponents and spokespersons are dishonest or merely deluded can be debated, but the outcome, dangerous misinformation, and the meltdown of on a civic discourse remains the same, as we once again see from this fiasco in Japan. Established at the dawn of the nuclear age, the pattern of dissemblance has become a well-worn rug long before the Japanese reactor spun out of control. In the early 1950s, the disciples of nuclear power, or the peaceful atoms, as it was called, insisted that nuclear power would soon become so cheap and efficient that it would be offered to consumers for free. Visionaries that they were, they suggested cities would be constructed with building materials impregnated with uranium so that snow removal would be unnecessary. Atomic bombs, they urged, should be used to carve out new coastal harbors for ships. In low doses, they swore radiation was actually beneficial to one's health. Such notions and outright fantasies, as well as propaganda for a new industry and a new way of war, even if laughable today, had tragic results back then. Thousands upon hundreds of thousands of American GIs, for instance, were marched into Ground Zero just after above-ground nuclear tests had been set off to observe their responses to what military planners assumed would be the atomic battlefield of the future. Ignorance, it turns out, is not bliss, and thousands of those soldiers later became ill, many died young. Unwary civilians who lived downwind of America's Western testing grounds were so exposed to nuclear fallout that many suffered horribly from a variety of cancers and other illnesses. Uranium miners exposed to radiation in the tunnels where they wrestled from the earth the raw materials for the nuclear age also became ill and died soon too, as did workers processing that uranium into weapons and fuel. Many of those miners were poor Navajo from my backyard in Utah, where a new uranium boom, part of the so-called nuclear renaissance, was, before Japan, set to take shape. In the future, today's low-risk claims from industry advocates will undoubtedly seem as tragically naive as yesterday's false claims. Yes, the likelihood that any specific nuclear power plant reactor will melt down may be slim indeed, which hardly means inconceivable. But to act as though nuclear risks are limited to the operation of power plants is misleading in the extreme. Spent fuel from reactors, the kind burning in Japan as we speak, is produced as a plant operates, and that fuel remains super hot and dangerous for thousands of years. As we are learning to our sorrow at the Japanese complex, such fuel is hardly spent. In fact, it can even be more radioactive and dangerous than reactor cores. Spent fuel continues to pile up in a nuclear waste stream that will have to be closely managed and monitored for hundreds of years, so long that those designing nuclear waste repositories struggle with the problem of what might be intelligible in the future, so distant today's languages may not be even understood. You might think that a danger virulent enough to outlast human languages would be a danger to avoid, but the hubris of the nuclear industry is equal to its willingness to deceive. A natural disaster, accident, terrorist attack that might be statistically unlikely in any year or decade becomes even more likely at the half-century, century, or half-millennium mark. Given enough time, in fact, the unlikely becomes almost inevitable, even if you and I are not the victims of some future apocalyptic disturbance of that lethal residue to consign our children, grandchildren, or great-grandchildren to such peril is plainly and profoundly immoral. Nuclear proponents have long wanted to limit the discussion of risk to plant operations alone, not to the storage of dangerous waste, and they remain eager to ignore altogether the risks inherent in transporting nuclear waste, moving those spent fuel rods to further places to be deposited represents a rarely acknowledged category of potential catastrophe. Just imagine a trainload of hot nuclear waste derailed somewhere. Catastrophic event, you bet. A major urban corridor with the ensuing evacuations of nearby inhabitants, it can happen. It means, in essence, that one of those pools of spent fuel rods that we're seeing now as a problem in Japan could be out of control waste going nuclear anywhere in our American landscape. Risk is about more than likelihood. It's also about impact. If I tell you that your chances of being bitten by a mosquito as you cross my yard are 1 in 100, you'll think of that risk differently than if I give you the same odds on a deadly pit viper. As events unfold in Japan, it's ever clear that we're talking about pit vipers, not mosquitoes. You wouldn't know it, though, if you were to debate nuclear industry representatives who consistently downplay both odds and impact and dismiss those who claim otherwise as hysterical doomsdayers. And Japan's accident will assumedly make their task somewhat more difficult. And let us not forget the hidden costs. The true costs of nuclear power are another subject carefully fudged and obscured by nuclear power advocates. From its inception in federally funded labs, nuclear power has been highly subsidized. A recent report by the Union of Concerned Scientists found that more than 30 subsidies have supported every stage of the nuclear fuel cycle, from uranium mining to long-term waste storage. Added together, these subsidies have often exceeded the average market price for the power produced. When it comes to producing electricity, these subsidies are so extensive, the report concludes, that in some cases it would have cost taxpayers less to simply buy the kilowatts on the open market and give them away. If the nuclear club in Congress, led by Senate Republican Mitch McConnell, gets his way, billions more in subsidies will be forthcoming, including massive federal loan guarantees to build the next generation of nuclear plants. These are particularly important to the industry, since bankers won't otherwise touch projects that are notorious for mammoth cost overruns, lengthy delays, and abrupt cancellations. The Obama administration has already proposed an additional $36 billion in such guarantees to underwrite new plant construction. That includes $4 billion for the construction of two new nuclear reactors on the Gulf Coast that are to be operated in partnership with the same Tokyo Electric Power Company, that's right, the very outfit that runs the Japanese failed plants. Yet when I debate nuclear advocates, they always claim that in cost terms, nuclear power outcompetes alternative sources of energy like wind and solar. That government gravy train doesn't just stop at new power plants either. The feds have long assured the epic cost of waste management and storage. If another multi-billion dollar project like the now abandoned Yucca Mountain Repository in Nevada is built, it will be with dollars from taxpayers and captive ratepayers. Industry spokesmen insist that subsidizing such a project will be well worth it, since they will create thousands of jobs. Unfortunately for them, a definitive University of Massachusetts study that analyzed various infrastructural investments, including wind, solar, retrofitting buildings to conserve energy, placed nuclear dead last in job creation. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening.